Long one of the country's preeminent satirists and short story writers, George Saunders won the Booker Prize for his first novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. It's a surreal, tragicomic rendering of the afterlife, a portrait of a divided country in the early days of the Civil War, and a moving rendering of a president's grief over the death of his beloved 11-year-old son, Willie, all of which takes place over the course of one night in Georgetown's Oak Hill Cemetery. As we approach President's Day, what can we learn from such an imaginative engagement with history? George Saunders joins us in studio. George Saunders is the author of numerous short stories, essays, and novellas. His most recent book, Lincoln in the Bardo, is his first novel. George, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is a most unusual novel. The New York Times described it as a, quoting here, weird folk art diorama of a cemetery come to life. What is this book about, and how do you describe it?
Well, that's a pretty good sales pitch right there, the diorama.
The diorama.
Yeah, it basically just, you know, I'd heard many years ago that Lincoln had been so grief-stricken when his son died that he actually entered the crypt on several occasions to interact with the body. And that idea just kind of stuck around for 20 years. And when I went to tell it, it seemed the best way would be to have a kind of chorus of ghosts to narrate it. So it's just your typical guy going into a grave narrated by a ghost story.
What exactly is the bardo of the title?
The bardo is a Tibetan word that means transitional space. So we're actually in one now. We're in the transition between birth and death. But the one the title refers to is that zone between the minute you die and whatever happens next. And it also kind of refers to the fact that Lincoln, in this moment of parental grief, you know, was at the low ebb of the Civil War and had to kind of make the transition through to being useful again.
It's a fascinating read. This is your first novel, but readers expecting a straightforward narrative might be surprised at what they find, almost a play-like text. Why did you choose this format?
You know, it was, you know, Hemingway says something in one of his books. They say, "How did you go broke?" And he says, "Gradually and then all at once." And it kind of evolved. When I write, I do a lot of iteration. I go back to it again and again. And it seemed like somehow the most honest way to do it. It didn't seem so fun to narrate it from Lincoln's point of view. So I just kind of blundered into it after several months.
Certainly as heck wasn't the easiest way to do it. This particular bardo is a product of your prodigious imagination. But as we said, Oak Hill Cemetery is a real place. If you've ever driven through Rock Creek Park past Georgetown, you've probably noticed it, a beautiful historic cemetery on the hillside running down to the creek. How did you draw from visits to the grounds?
Well, the idea came exactly as you said. We were driving by in the parkway, and my wife's cousin just pointed up there. And you can see the crypt from there. So then I went back several times, and the first time I couldn't find Willie Lincoln's grave, and then the same cousin actually went off and did a little reconnoitering and found it. And I went back probably three or four times just to kind of get the feeling of it. And then at one point I thought, okay, I'm going to do this. I'll make a map. I'll write down all the names of the adjoining graves. And I brought all that back with me. And then, you know, at some point with a novel, that's not really what's important. It's not a catalog. It's a dramatic adventure. So I started making up the names and fudging the geography a little bit. But the mood of that place is so beautiful. And that really got into the book.
People have been showing up at the Oak Hill Cemetery after reading the book, some of them with the book in hand. Did that surprise you?
I love it. And I have to be honest, before I wrote it, I kind of thought that would be cool. Maybe a Halloween event or something. But no, that's very touching. You know, it really is. I've done that. You know, I've gone to Hemingway's house, or you drive through Lorain, Ohio, where Toni Morrison was from, and you go on, you know. So I think that means the book meant something to you.
So you fantasize that if this book is okay, then people may go to Oak Hill Cemetery with the book in hand, but I'm not going to let myself believe that right now.
Exactly.
And then
right,
it happens.
Because then you see what a crazy idea that is. But, you know, then it did happen, and it's very nice.
Historical fiction had not exactly been your thing up until now. How did you make the shift to telling a story that was rooted in real events and places?
Yeah. The you know, sometimes if you, especially as you get towards the, you know, middle or end of your artistic life, it's a really good thing to put yourself under constraint and to sort of deny yourself your usual gifts. And in this case, I couldn't do what I love to do most, which is write funny contemporary language. So I had to do some kind of a simulation of 19th century language. So it was a bit like having some leg weights on. And I really liked it. It kind of forced me to learn how to do different things with language. It also allowed a little more sincerity. When you're writing about the death of a child, there's a time when you just have to put the satirical tools down and look right at the thing. And that was, at, you know, 59, it was refreshing to be able to do that.
If you have questions or comments for George Saunders, give us a call, 800-433-8850. Have you ever visited Oak Hill Cemetery in Georgetown? Do you know which historic figures are buried there? 800-433-8850. Also joining me in studio is Erin Carlson Mesh. She is the Executive Director of President Lincoln's Cottage. Erin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Eric, for having me, Kojo.
It's impossible to talk about places in D.C. relevant to President Lincoln without mentioning his summer cottage in Petworth, now a historic site where you serve as the executive director. Tell us a little bit about the cottage and the role it played in Lincoln's life.
President Lincoln, the cottage is where President Lincoln and his wife and son Tad came to live throughout a full year of his presidency. They first visited the day after his inauguration, last visited the day before his assassination. But they didn't actually start living there until the summer of 1862. And Mary Lincoln wrote that in their time of sorrow, quiet was very necessary to them. But they didn't really find quiet out there. In the first summer in residence, Lincoln worked on the Emancipation Proclamation. It was also an active home for veterans at the time. It still is today. So there were retired and disabled soldiers living right next door. And in addition, there is the predecessor of Arlington National Cemetery just 200 yards away. So 1,000 soldiers were buried in plain view of Lincoln's front door the first summer he was living there.
It might surprise people to learn that the summer White House, the Country Escape, is in a built-up residential area of Petworth in the district. What would it have been like in Lincoln's day?
That's right. In Lincoln's time, it was out in the country. So these were sprawling estates, and the property that's now the Armed Forces Retirement Home originally belonged to George Washington Riggs, who was the co-founder of Riggs Bank. And his business partner had the estate just south of that. So this was really out in the country. And, you know, Lincoln complained about the road conditions, which is something that Washingtonians would appreciate. And it was a bit of a haul. By making the choice to live out there, he was turning himself into a commuter. And so he was creating a situation where he had a 45-minute commute between his summer cottage and the White House, where he went to work most days.
People who look at it today are going like, a 45-minute commute? Well, given the traffic in downtown Washington today, it's probably a 45-minute commute again. But Lincoln's cottage, as you mentioned, sits next to the grounds of the Soldiers' Home National Cemetery. What was happening there during the Civil War, and how did it affect Lincoln?
Yeah. Well, we know that it was already being used as a cemetery by the soldiers' home. But with so many of the war wounded pouring into Washington, D.C., into the area hospitals, there was a need to find cemetery space. And so Montgomery Meigs approached the soldiers' home about using the space in that cemetery, and that's what they did. And so between 1861 and 1864, that cemetery was used for a lot of the soldier burials in the area. Because most of them came from the area hospitals, they're actually very well recorded, too. And we know that Lincoln was walking through the cemetery. There are various accounts of that, about him walking through at night, about him meeting with people there who had come to seek him at the cottage. In one occasion, even reciting lines of poetry over some of the graves that were there.
So it kept vivid the reality of the Civil War at the time.
He absolutely understood the human cost of the war. He was seeing it there in the refugee camps along his commute route and in the war wounded being brought into the city on the commute route as well.
Here now is Linda in Arlington, Virginia. Linda, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. I just want to bring into the discussion a Washington resident during this period, William Wilson Corcoran, who is buried and actually was the founder of Oak Hill Cemetery. And it's his mausoleum that you can see from Rock Creek as you drive past looking up on the hill. Also, he has an association with the Lincoln Cottage. His was the third residence, Harewood, in that region, and his property at Harewood was used for a military hospital during the Civil War. As you probably all know, William Wilson Corcoran is the founder of the Corcoran Gallery and School of Art now. Changed dramatically from what it was in his time. But during the period of the Civil War, William Wilson Corcoran spent his time in Europe, where his son-in-law, Mr. Eustace, was a representative for the Confederate States. In any case, there are strong associations of the Corcorans and local history for these two sites that you're discussing.
Glad you mentioned that, because I did ask, do you know which historic figures are buried at the cemetery? Thank you very much for your call. Linda, here is John Paul in Georgetown. John Paul, your turn.
Hi, Mr. Saunders. I'm a huge fan, and I'm also from the southwest suburbs of Chicago in Burbank, Illinois. I happen to live across the street from Oak Hill Cemetery, haven't read the book yet, but it's next on my list. I just wanted to ask if, in your short stories, how much the characters from the region and where you grew up influence you, because I feel like I know all of these characters at one point or another because of the southwest side of Chicago type character.
Sure. Yeah, I've been to Burbank many times. You know what I found is that the day that I realized that all of my relatives and friends and their fathers were poets, you know, they were Southside poets, and they had a full human soul in there, and sometimes the opening got a little crimped, and they would express themselves through a joke or a knee to the groin or something. But basically, they were, you know, that's really what poetry is a full feeling through a small opening. So that Southside stuff is very, very much in my work for sure.
Every time I got a knee to the groin, I felt like I was a poet.
But
that's another story. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation with George Saunders. His most recent book is called Lincoln in the Bardo. And Erin Carlton Mash, she's the executive director of President Lincoln's Cottage. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back. We're talking with George Saunders. He's the author of numerous short stories, essays, and novellas. His most recent book, Lincoln in the Bardo, is his first novel. Also joining us in studio is Erin Carlson Mash. She's the executive director of President Lincoln's College. George, you depict Lincoln wrestling with the weights of both his personal grief and the tragedy of war. Can you read us one of those passages where readers get to peer into Lincoln's mind, courtesy of the ghosts who dive into the president's body and recount his stream of consciousness?
Sure. This is a section where he's just turned his mind to all the dead that he sort of feels responsible for. So he thinks of his son. He is just one, and the weight of it about to kill me. Have exported this grief some 3,000 times so far to date. A mountain of boys, someone's boys. Must keep on with it. May not have the heart for it. One thing to pull a lever when blind to the result, but here lies one dear example of what I accomplish by the orders. I may not have the heart for it. What to do? Call a halt? Toss down the loss hole those 3,000? Sue for peace? Become great course-reversing fool, king of indecision, laughingstock for the ages, waffling hick, slim Mr. Turnabout? It is out of control. Who is doing it? Who caused it? Whose arrival on the scene began it? What am I doing? What am I doing here? Everything nonsense now. Those mourners came up, hands extended, sons intact, wearing on their faces enforced sadness masks to hide any sign of their happiness, which went on. They could not hide how alive they yet were with it, with their happiness at the potential of their still living sons. Until lately, I was one of them, strolling, whistling through the slaughterhouse, averting my eyes from the carnage, able to laugh and dream and hope because it had not yet happened to me.
George Saunders, reading from his most recent book, Lincoln in the Bardo, a novel. George, clearly he's feeling the weight of the Civil War here. As we come up on President's Day, there are few more revered figures in American history than Abraham Lincoln. How did you manage to get into his head?
Well, you know, when you're making a character, you're sort of supplying a lot of your own stuff and assuming that, you know, that he was just like you. So there's about 30% of my belief. And then a lot of it really for me was just to say, Lord knows I can't represent Lincoln in its totality, but I might be able to catch him between 11:45 and 11:50 on that particular night. And you have the gifts of specificity. So it's cold out. He's been up all day. You kind of know where he just came from and where he's headed. So you can kind of remember there used to be a commercial where the person would say, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. So there's something to that. You know, if you took on the job of representing Lincoln, I think you couldn't get started. But to say, I'm going to show a grieving father for 6 minutes, that you can kind of do, you know.
Aaron, in the book and in real life, President Lincoln and his wife took refuge at the cottage after the death of their son. Tell us a little bit about that time in the president's life and how he might have spent his days at the cottage.
Yeah. Well, we know that he wasn't just sort of using it as a retreat where he was, you know, burying his head in the sand. We know that he was bringing his work home with him. And in fact, you know, a lot of people know that Lincoln saved notes and stuck them in the lining of his top hat. And that first summer they're living there, he is working on the Emancipation Proclamation. We know that. There's numerous accounts. And William Slade, his valet, talks about the fact that Lincoln would sometimes leave these little bits of paper all over the place, and he would, you know, maybe sometimes didn't get it into his hat, but Slade would gather them up and put them in a desk, and that by the time Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, he knew it by heart. But we also know that, you know, Tad was there, and Lincoln spent time with his son Tad. By the end of that first summer, there's also a group of young men, teenagers and early 20-something, who were assigned as his presidential guard. And in many ways, he was a surrogate father figure for them and for his son Tad, and that they were also serving as surrogate big brothers for young Tad. There are stories of him playing checkers on the porch, so he did certainly have those moments. By and large, we also know that the war was weighing very heavily on him.
You mentioned Ted, and George, I wanted to mention Mary Lincoln. She does not make an appearance in this book. Why is that?
Well, you know, she makes a very brief one, almost an afterthought. You know, my experience is that a book has a technical life that you have to honor. And then, in this case, Lincoln's mind was, I thought, mostly on Willie, that, you know, throughout the course of the book. Mm-hmm. And I had originally planned that he would visit the crypt 3 times and then come home during the day, and then that's where Mary would come in. But when I tried to do it, it's just the energy would drop every time it became daytime, basically. Mm-hmm. So then, therefore, Mary gets shunted to the side. And in the end, I thought, well, you know, actually, if you were that person, maybe, and he also doesn't think of Tad very much. Mm-hmm. So my thought is, well, you're in the graveyard for an hour and a half, the last goodbye to your son. Maybe those people in your family fall by the wayside a little bit. But I think they had I think she's gotten kind of a bum rap over the years. I think they were really in love. And I read somewhere that he was incredibly attractive to women, actually, and knew it. And he also was very attracted to women. But out of deference to her, he would kind of fend off any flirtation and kind of keep, you know.
And she kind of helped, too.
I think she helped fend, yeah. She was a good fender.
Here is David in Potomac, Maryland. David, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, one of the great things about the book is the number of voices that are reflected throughout the pages. I really enjoyed that. Also, there is a virtual reality portrayal of portions of the book. I don't know if it's still on the New York Times website, but it was on the New York Times website. It really gives an interesting perspective to the story.
Yeah, thanks.
I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, there was a great director named Graham Sack who had the idea of making a little 10-minute video. So if you go to the Times site and get the goggles, you'll have the experience of looking at Willie, and he says, Father, and you turn, and Lincoln brushes right by you. It's a really thrilling thing. Yeah, thank you for mentioning
that. In addition to the narration from the panoply of ghosts, excerpts from primary sources and historical accounts are cut up and interspersed throughout the book, giving the reader a sense of the external events taking place outside the cemetery. But some are real, others invented. It's impossible for the casual reader to discern the difference. I certainly couldn't. You've said that you didn't want to be too caught up in some of the historic details. How did you choose where to venture into literary invention? And were there particular details or events that you felt were important to stay true to life?
Yes. My policy was I wasn't going to do any significant distortion, so I would only invent a historical tidbit when it just made the truth more evident. So I thought that was kind of the novelist's prerogative. So mainly I wouldn't do anything like have Lincoln do something he didn't actually do, as far as I could figure it out. So it was kind of, at one point I had I had put a bunch of fake ones in, and when you read it, you could tell which ones were fake because those are the ones where I was showing off the most. They were the funniest and the liveliest. So then the kind of difficult task was to go through and tone all of those down so that ideally a reader wouldn't be able to tell what was true from what was made up.
Glad you mentioned the funniest and the liveliest, and because, Aaron, this book paints a picture of personal grief with the added weight of the Civil War on Lincoln's soldiers, but there's also a lot of humor bandied about. How does that resonate with what really happened?
Well, in a surreal sense, it does. And we know that Lincoln also used satire, and political satire in particular, as a valve, a release valve. Humor has a way of revealing the truth in a lot of senses. And we know that Lincoln both used it as a sword and used it himself also as a release.
This book ventures into the supernatural, and that part is not totally fictionalized. Writing in Smithsonian Magazine, historian David Ward points out, quoting here, that for 19th century Americans, the prospect of communicating with the spirit world, of regaining contact with lost loved ones, especially children, was tantalizing. Lincoln and the Bardo not only breaks new literary ground, but raises fascinating questions about Lincoln's deep interest in the supernatural and spirit world. What can you tell us about that aspect of his life?
Right. Well, we know that spiritualism was really on the rise in mid-19th century America. And in many ways, it's a very democratic type of religion. You don't have to go through a hierarchy to speak with people from the afterlife. And we know that it really was also very popular during the Civil War for some of the more obvious reasons, and that Mary Lincoln herself actually engaged in seances, including one, at least one, at the cottage. Hmm. And while Lincoln was both fascinated by it, he was also very concerned with the idea that Mary might have been getting taken advantage of. And we know at least in one case, there's documented evidence of someone putting one over on her.
Hmm. Hmm.
We got an email from Molly who says, I love how Lincoln and the Bardo blended real accounts of certain events with fictional ones. Did you do a lot of research for the book? It's really the best, most imaginative, and most moving novel I've read in ages.
I love that question. Hey. Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Molly. Yeah, I did a lot of research. The idea came to me 20 years ago, so in that time I was kind of casually reading, not really thinking I'd make a book out of it. And then once I got started, there was kind of two things. One would be, you know, there's that party scene at the beginning, so I'd have to find everything I could about that and type it up and cut it up. And then other times you'd find something in the research that you thought, oh, gosh, I hope I can find somewhere to put this. So there's a great book called The Physical Lincoln. It's every single description of Lincoln's physical body that's ever been made is in this book. So you find something like that, and you think, oh, I have to find a place where. And then the book will actually, you know, lead you to it. Like at one point I was writing, and one of the characters said of Lincoln, and what a face it was. And then suddenly you're like, oh, I know what goes next.
Yeah.
You know,
so.
Okay. Eileen sends us a tweet. Lincoln and the Bardo helped me to grieve my brother's unexpected death in 2016. I am awed by and grateful for George Saunders' genius.
Well, thank you, and I'm so sorry for your loss, and I'm glad it was helpful. I hope it was.
On to the phones again. Here is Elena in Northwest Washington. Elena, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Good afternoon, everyone. I literally just left Lincoln's Cottage in Petworth. My daughter attends the Petworth Cooperative Playgroup that is held inside the cottage. And I'm a Petworth native myself, born and raised there. Parents moved to the area in the 60s. So I lived in walking distance of it. And it's wonderful that it's being referenced because it is a fascinating place. The book sounds fascinating. I haven't read it, but I encourage all. I mean, we have so much history in D.C. and now right in our neighborhood. There's renewed interest in the cottage, and I just wanted to encourage everyone to take the time out to visit.
Thank you very much for your call. We got a tweet from Dan who said, President Lincoln's cottage is one of the most magnificent sites in D.C. Rarely have I felt history come alive to the extent I did within its walls. Aaron, while the renovations to Lincoln's cottage, which were completed, I think, about a decade ago, show the house how it would have been in Lincoln's time, it's not a museum stuffed with artifacts. In what other ways does Lincoln's Cottage bring the 16th president to life for visitors?
That's right. We made and it is actually our 10-year anniversary on President's Day this year. It's hard to believe that it's been 10 years, mm-hmm. and they've been a wonderful 10 years. But we made a conscious decision to not emphasize, not to fill the house with a bunch of stuff that may or may not have been there or that may or may not have looked like what was there, because that's really not what was important to Lincoln, and it's not what makes the place important. It's the physical space, the whole property, the views that you have, what's nearby, and the ideas that he really nurtured while he was living there. And so we endeavored to make a museum of ideas. We call it a home for brave ideas because some of the ideas Lincoln developed there or that are related to his time there really do show courage and bravery. And we strive to be that for people today as well.
Oh, here is Matt in downtown Washington. Matt, your turn. We only have about a minute and a half left.
Okay, thanks. I just want to say I'm a huge fan, Mr. Saunders, and I made a promise to myself a few years ago to read new writers, and reading this book was the crown jewel of that experience, anticipating it and reading it. I wanted to know for your fans, can you tell us anything about what's next?
Well, you know, my policy has always been don't have any ideas at the beginning, because whenever I do that, I mess it up. You know, I'll have an idea, and then 2 years later, it's a pamphlet. So I've just started a new story, and I'm just kind of trying to wade in there like with complete beginner mind and see what it says to me. But it's nice knowing you're out there. Thank you.
Well, John sent us an email to ask, is a play or movie in the works for Lincoln and the Bardo?
Yeah, Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally and I are working on sort of an approach. So it won't be immediate, but we're hoping to make it as weird as the book.
How did writing a novel feel, and will you continue with that form?
It felt good. All those years I said I didn't care about it, and when I actually did it, I was very happy. No, it was great, and if another idea comes along that insists on being long, I'll be happy to do it, but... Yeah,
George Saunders, he's the author of numerous short stories, essays, and novellas. His most recent book, Lincoln in the Bardo, is his first novel. George Saunders, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Aaron Carlson Mest is the executive director of President Lincoln's College. Aaron, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for the show today. Learn more about it online at kojoshow.org. You can read an excerpt from Lincoln in the Bardo on this show's page. There you'll also find a link to our show about President Lincoln's Cottage, one of our favorite off-the-beaten-path locations in the district. You may have heard WAMU's series No Easy Access about the challenges many Washingtonians face in obtaining food, transportation, and health care. Tomorrow, we'll meet with neighborhood leaders to discuss solutions to those challenges. That's tomorrow at noon. Until then, thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.